Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Okay, well, actually.
Go on.
Can I start? I'm going to start for a little bit. I was just rereading it on the tube. I'm going to read a bit. I'll read it to you. And in the book, there's a marvellous section, which I'm going to read to you, which is so familiar to anybody who's... And everybody has done this. Everybody's tried to write an essay at school about the group that they're most passionate about. And our hero, Philip, I think, enters this piece, and this is the first two paragraphs for the school magazine. And it goes, this is so well written, it's so funny. It just goes, Tales from Topographic Oceans is the fifth album from Yes, without doubt the most musically talented and advanced group in Britain today, if not the world. Without doubt, this is their masterpiece. The concept behind the album was created by John Anderson, Yes's brilliant lead singer and songwriter. Hailing from Accrington Lancs, hailing from his great actually led. Anderson has always had an affinity with Eastern spiritualism and philosophy. Inspired by Paramhansa Yoganda's autobiography of a yogi, brackets nothing to do with Jellystone National Park, exclamation mark. The album is a double album with four sides, each containing only one long song, comprising four long songs in total. The shortest of these is 18 minutes 34 seconds, while the longest is 21 minutes 35 seconds long.
That's important.
That's very important. It's absolutely crucial. All teenage boys interested in prog. This is a key thing. And he goes on to say, only Mike Oldfield's Tubular Bells has longer pieces of music on each side, to the best of my knowledge. But this album has four, whereas Tubular Bells has only two. Isn't that perfect?
It is.
And this is. If I will actually explain, I am talking to the author, of course, Jonathan Coe. And if you'd read Rotters Club whenever it came out a while ago now, actually, you will remember this.
10 years ago now, yeah.
Yeah,
10 years ago.
Full of wonderful rock and roll references. Now, would that be Philip in this book? I suspect would be you were born, I think, in around 61, was it?
61, exactly.
So would this be condemned? Were you too as obsessed with Yes? And I know you were with Hatfield North, because that is, in fact, the Rotters Club, in fact, is the title of one of their tracks, isn't it?
Yeah, one of their albums.
Their albums.
Well, first of all, can I just say that I was chuckling away when you were reading that. I haven't read this book or really kind of looked at it for 10 years, and that's a very funny passage in your rendition. We should have got you to do the audio book. You're the perfect,
I should have
on my perfect
sort of
performer.
Swotty student voice, which is that kind of...
Yes.
So you slightly can't quite pronounce the R's, you know, frankly exciting. You know. But it's brilliant because teenage boys at that age just are the concept of Yes is actually more important really than the music. It's the idea that the songs are so long. I was the same. I had a Soft Machine record, which had four tracks on double album.
Moon in June. And,
you know it. Yes. Of course you do. Soft Machine 3.
Soft Machine 3.
Two sides, four tracks, do the math.
Yeah. Actually, thrilling. Phil is probably wrong in his assessment of the of Tales from Topographic Oceans next, actually, because maybe Soft Machine 3 has longer tracks.
It may well
I'm sure
do.
Your listeners will be able to...
And they will do. Please do point
correct
that out.
Us about that. But I suppose the, what that makes me remember is that to simplify things completely, if you imagine a classroom divided up into two camps, say 1976, a bit later than that piece, so you've got the punk aficionados on one side who are just kind of getting into that new music, then you've got the Yes and Genesis fans on the other side who are discussing which album has the longest tracks.
Which is a great division.
Maybe Foxtrot, what is it, Supper's Ready, maybe that's longer than any of the tracks.
Could be, absolutely.
Yeah, could be. So I'm the boy kind of standing in the corner, kind of wishing a plague on both your houses and thinking that actually he's superior to both of them because I'm into kind of Henry Cow, who are far, you know, who are more musically complex even than Yes and more kind of radical politically than punk. So I feel that I'm the kind of...
That's, you know, a brilliant position to take up, of course.
Well, it's very lonely.
Slightly superior. Very lonely. I was going to say, were there anyone else? Was anyone else in your gang?
Not really. No, not really, I don't think.
I mean, were you going to school with a satchel with the words Peter Blegvad written on them, who I think was a member of Henry Cavill? Everybody was a member of Henry Cavill.
Everybody Fred was Frith. At some point. Fred Frith was a big hero, yes. So there weren't many people, you know, in the arguments in the classroom about who was the greatest guitarist. Was it Steve Howe? Was it John Paul Jones or whatever? The name Fred Frith didn't very often come up, but it would have done if I'd joined in, probably, because that would have been the name I would have pitched in with.
Why did you like those groups? Because I never get tired of hearing about people's obsessions. And it doesn't really matter who they're obsessed with. I just approve of the idea of being obsessed.
Yeah.
So Henry Cow, I remember I never felt that strongly about them. But what was it about them that you liked so much?
You know, I was thinking as preparation for coming in and doing this podcast about my musical journey, and it was quite a weird one, actually. And I'll tell you who to point, actually, the finger of blame at for all my, you know, the fact that my musical interest took this weird byway. And it's Jeff Lynne, actually.
Oh, right.
That is the weird thing.
Of ELO.
Of ELO, because when I first records I bought were rock and roll. When I was about 11 or so, I had slightly retro tastes, and I was buying compilation albums by Bill Haley and Chuck Berry and people like this, and I liked just kind of, you know, three-chord rock and roll songs.
That's a peculiar thing to be doing at the time.
Yeah, it is slightly peculiar.
Why would you have not been looking at the present? The present was so exciting at that time.
The present was exciting. Well, I must have bought Electric Warrior at the same time, the same year that I bought,
right.
I was buying that stuff.
Okay, so that's
so there's a kind of continuum there. But then ELO did their cover of Roll Over Beethoven, which I really liked the song because I knew the Chuck Berry version. And that made me buy, or encouraged me to buy, ELO 2, which, as anybody who knows the early work of ELO will attest, is a diehard prog rock album with only five tracks, the longest, Kiama, being more than...
I think you'll find only five tracks.
clocking in more than 11 minutes. And that was my undoing, that album, because I suddenly thought, no, we don't want this three chords, 2.5 minutes. We want, you know, we want riffs in 7/4, and we want cellos and violins and all this kind of stuff. And that's what, of course, Jeff Lynne ditched all that stuff almost immediately and went on to become a great pop writer.
Riffs in 7/4 is so well put. Because I really remember that as well at school. It's terrible, but Stuart McConey is brilliant on this subject. The awful superiority you felt by liking music was in 7/4 as opposed to 4/4.
Yeah.
That somehow just put you on a kind of intellectual level above everybody else.
Yeah.
And so there you were in the corner of the classroom, looking down.
Yeah.
Rather condescendingly at Adam and the Ants fans.
Stuart still likes all this kind of music.
He adores it.
And if the Freak Zone had existed in the 1970s, I would have been in heaven. But of course,
absolutely,
we did have shows like that. I mean, people forget that John Peel actually played a lot of this kind of music. He played a lot of, right up till the late 70s, he was playing...
Huge amount.
He was playing Henry Cow and Gentle Giant and Caravan and stuff like this, along with, you know, all
it's
the punk stuff.
It's not until he heard the Ramones did he suddenly...
He didn't stop suddenly then either. I mean, I think he kept on playing it all through the 70s.
It was a gradual baton change, wasn't it?
Gradual,
I mean, after the 80s, he was very embarrassed about
people
it.
People think that, you know, Never Mind the Bollocks came out and that was it. Everything changed. But actually, it was a much more gradual and seamless process than that. So we had his show. We had Alan Freeman's Saturday show on a Saturday afternoon. Essential listening with all those weird kind of classical jingles that he used to drop in.
That's right.
And a weird show, which I used to love, called Sounds Interesting with Derek Jewell. Does anyone remember
this? I remember
this,
that.
This show? This
I don't remember
on
that.
It was Radio 3. It was Radio 3's only toe dipping into pop music.
That's
and this guy had a very, very posh voice. And, the new Genesis album or something would be a big feature. He would probably play the whole thing in its entirety.
I would imagine.
Yeah, I'd imagine so.
God bless Derek. Where would we be? Again, the idea, I think he did have quite a plumby voice. And also, Sounds Interesting is one of those wonderful sort of archaic old BBC names, isn't it? You know,
yeah,
it's like,
absolutely.
Pop, look and listen, you know, those kind of things. Fantastic. So what were the absences, which were the records you were most obsessed with? I mean, did you have a sort of stick up on your bedroom wall, a cover or a... Were there any posters, in fact?
Any posters? Let me think. I was pretty obsessed... Here's a name which you probably won't recognise, but some of the listeners might. Bo Hansson. Bo Hansson, the Swedish keyboard player who did an album called Music Inspired by Lord of the Rings. Now, of course, we all read Lord of the Rings at the time.
We did.
That was our Bible.
We did.
And he did this this instrumental concept album released on the famous Charisma label in 72, 73, I think. And that was one of my obsessions. I listened to that endlessly, and all his other records, which nobody apart from me bought, I don't think. And poor old Bo died last year, I found, and not a single obituary in
not
national papers,
obituary.
Which I think was a bit...
Not a single flag at half-mast.
No,
apart from the Coe household.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, where we all wore black.
I noticed that
week.
We all wore exactly. I noticed there's a kind of keyboard pattern emerging to your appreciation of rock music. It's mostly... And you are a keyboard player yourself.
I am a keyboard player, but guitar was my first instrument, as it has to be, I suppose. Everyone starts by getting their first electric guitar or something around about the age of 10 or 11, I think I was, when I got mine.
So we were going to come to, in a minute, to the group that you formed at college, and in fact reformed now and done some recordings. But presumably before that, there were other bands. What names did they have, your early bands?
I don't think there were any other bands before
that. You went straight into the peer group.
Because of this lonely position I found myself in at school, which I described to you. I mean, there is a scene in the Rotters Club, a rather tragi-comic scene where Benjamin and Philip form their kind of progressive concept album band, and the drummer and the bass player rebel in mid-rehearsal and kind of kick the instruments over and turn into a punk band kind of in mid-song, basically.
Brilliant.
And that is
at
almost...
the speed at which things happen in documentaries.
Yes.
Brilliant, yes.
That's almost a kind of flight of fantasy on my part, because I never, you know, I never even got as far as forming that ridiculous progressive kind of band that they do. So I used to do solo recordings when I was at school. I used to have a very primitive overdub technique, which involved recording backing tracks onto a tape recorder and then just playing back with them and recording that onto another tape recorder and then bouncing it backwards and forwards.
And each time you recorded it, the quality would depreciate.
Yeah, more and more hiss.
Just hiss.
Yes, it's basically just hiss.
It makes it sound like somebody behind a distant rubber mattress.
Yes.
Underwater.
Yes. That's right.
How very devoted. So everyone else has got their best, but you're on your own, overdubbing.
Yeah,
I think hugely complicated. Probably 7/4 keyboard parts.
I think I saw myself as Mike Oldfield at that point.
Yes.
I was probably doing kind of Tubular Bells 2, 3, and 4 in my head. That's probably what that was about.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the terrifying thing about Mark Oldfield, of course, at the time was he was only 17 or something.
Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, I think he's... You know, I remember buying the records, I think he was only just a tiny bit older than me. It's appallingly prodigious talent, you know. But the peer group is the group that you formed, I think, when you were at Cambridge, when you were at Trinity College, Cambridge.
It was after I left Cambridge, actually. It was when I was a postgrad at Warwick University.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Which, Fraser and I were discussing this yesterday... Actually, a very good name for a band, the peer group.
I think so. Yeah.
There was lots of bands called the Elastic Band, weren't there, and the T Set, and whatever kind of facetious send up.
Well, I think my memory
but the
is
peer group is actually quite a good name. I think
my memory is that the Monochrome Set was the inspiration for the band name, because we liked the idea that the second word in the band's name could mean group or band or something like that.
Yes,
so the Monochrome Set, which I always thought was very clever,
very, very,
very clever name. And they just reformed, I noticed, in 2011.
Them.
So,
God bless them. Leicester Square,
guitar, of course.
Bid.
On lead vocals.
I think on vocals.
Songwriting, yep.
Andy Warren was a member at one stage,
yep.
I think, went on to be
yep.
in the Ants.
Yep.
Fraser, stop us at any point if you think
it's boring.
Oh, no, you
carry on.
Leicester Square, again, Leicester Square, underrated name for
that's a fantastic name, actually.
Superb name.
Yeah.
The Monochrome Set, phrase, I think one must remind ourselves, had like the Monkees had a song, Hey, Hey, with the Monkees, and Soft Boys had Give It to the Soft Boys. They had a song called The Monochrome Set, which was their opening track, in which two members of the group simply sang the backing vocal on the word the. So Bid would go, Monochrome Set, and the others would go, the, didn't they? Do you remember? I used to think it was absolutely... Maybe you and I were at the same Monochrome Set concert. It's quite possible.
I never saw them live, so I don't think so, but they were, I wish
they,
I had.
Oh, they
I
were
had.
Terrific.
Yeah.
Terrific.
Yeah.
But you formed them, so the group was, I think, apart from a Smith song you once told me, I think there was a... Which Smith song did you cover?
We covered This Charming Man. Rather winsome lyrical sort of version.
Very difficult song to play.
A lot of chord changes. Very, very
enormously
quick.
Difficult.
Yeah, and a very difficult guitar part, which luckily I wasn't having to handle. But
no,
Yeah, in fact, I don't know if there are any.
At what point in the set was that? Was that the final? So we'll leave you with this one. The final big dance number.
I don't remember now. I don't think it was our final number. But we started. I tried to start it as a prog band, really, I suppose, because we mainly did instrumentals, and we did our keynote song was in 7/4 and lasted 9 minutes.
So even the concept of a keynote song is exciting. What was it called? See, that's another good indication of what music sounds like. It's just hearing the titles. Can you remember the titles of any of these songs?
The long song in 7/4 was called Juliet and the China Men.
Excellent. Excellent.
But our titles weren't very proggy. We had a track called I Would If I Could But I Can't, I remember, which is I think is a distant memory of some joke we used to tell in the playground where the punchline was I Would If I Could But I Can't.
Yes.
But I don't remember that. But anyway, the other members of the band, rather in the way that happens in the Rotters Club, although over a period of months rather than minutes, they rebelled against this nonsense, and we started having more and more vocals and shorter songs, and the other members of the band started writing more, and we turned into a song outfit rather than an instrumental outfit.
And you wrote the music and words, or just the music?
Just the music.
Why didn't you write the words? Because we'll get on to the Reform group in a moment. I notice you don't write the words in the Reform group. You would think that the one person, one group member, the man who's written 9 novels, would probably be the man who should be pulling out the goose quill.
Well, not really, because, you know, 9 novels, some of which clock in at about 500 pages. So that's how long it takes me to say what I want to say, really. And if you've only got 3.5 minutes and 2 verses and a chorus, then I'm a bit stumped, actually.
Oh, right.
I find
brevity.
It very hard. Brevity
and
is not,
focus and
is not,
compression,
not my
your...
thing. Not my thing. I have written lyrics. I've got a very good friend who's a wonderful singer-songwriter, Louis Philippe, who used to record for the L label in
You've
back
recorded
in the 80s.
With him, actually, haven't you?
I did an album with him of readings from my books with his music in the background. That came out on a French label in the early 2000s, called 9th and 13th. And I've written some lyrics for some of his songs. And I've written some lyrics for Richard Sinclair, who used to sing with Caravan.
Yes, absolutely.
But you know, it doesn't come easily to me at all. And I don't think they were any of these lyrics were particularly successful. So
but
I'm,
you
so
think
I'm,
that prog, if it was a prog group, which it obviously was,
yeah.
Prog would be the easiest of lyrics to write if brevity didn't suit you.
Yeah, but
because
prog lyrics are almost universally terrible, aren't they? I mean,
that's a good subject. Now, that is a good subject. We had this discussion only the other day in the Word office. Oh, the banter. Talking about the record Fragile by Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And is it the track Roundabout? I think it is. Do you remember? And whether or not John Anderson could only write about nebulous concepts like clouds and golden dogs.
Good question. Did any of those prog bands ever write about feelings? In fact, is there a prog love song? It's there aren't many.
I don't think there are. I think they're mostly just really woolly sense impressions.
Yeah.
A fabulous utopia,
yes,
that you would enter to escape the drudgery of normal life.
Yeah. A lot of John Anderson's were about love, but it's a big kind of universal concept, I guess, weren't they?
It was
individual
precisely that it was about the overall concept of love, not I broke up with Rosie on Tuesday in the pub,
no,
and I'm heartbroken.
If we loved each other, we could heal the world, and
we could heal the world and ourselves and live on a cloud.
Yeah.
Probably, and be served drinks by a unicorn.
And what's wrong with that?
nothing's wrong with that. I'm not knocking it. Sounds terrific.
But is this why it's such a male genre, do you think? That, you know, there are not many female prog fans.
Well,
is this the same reason that mainly it's men who read kind of fantasy novels and this kind of thing?
I think so. There's a very good piece, actually, which I shall plug now, actually, in the current edition of The Word. It is in the new edition, isn't it? Sarah Dempster's piece. Sarah Dempster is an absolute prog obsessive.
I know. She did an interview with me about my books for you, I think, a couple of years ago, and I was delighted to find that she
did them. So, of course it was. Absolutely.
She knows all this stuff backwards.
I was really impressed, and she liked, of many aspects of prog, she liked the pretension.
Mm.
She found that intensely attractive. I think she thought that the kind of prosaic world of blokes with leather jackets, stubble, pints of beer. It just wasn't very romantic, and she just loved this idea of this sort of... The whole thing is just a great sort of meringue of ridiculousness that you could just dive into. And it was all kind of pink and fluffy and candy floss and nonsensical. And I was very... This is a terrific piece, actually, I currently see. And anyone listening who hasn't read it, I would direct them to it.
The Word, a magazine, a website, a podcast... A way of life.
But so the peer group, would you just explain firstly that the group have, of course, reformed? This is the band from college.
Yeah, well, we thought it'd be nice to start doing some recording again because we remembered how much we'd enjoyed doing it 25 years ago. And, of course, technology now has changed completely. We're all scattered in different parts of the country, so we can't kind of reform a play together or anything like that. But you can bounce tracks backwards and forwards via email.
So this is a band that's reformed.
It's a virtual band.
That's great.
And of course you can just stick stuff online and do things that way. So it just seemed the right moment to kind of do it again. Really,
you don't have the equipment to play simultaneously, do you? I assume. I went 10 years ago to the flat in Covent Garden of Dave Stewart, formerly of Eurythmics, and now of virtually everything else. Super Heavy, in fact. Mm-hmm. And he demonstrated to me a keyboard that he pulled out and a load of screens. And he was playing live with a musician in South America, in North America, and somebody in Sweden. Mm. There was a four-piece group playing. But it wasn't
That's extraordinary.
It was extraordinary, but it wasn't entirely satisfying because it wasn't quite synced.
Yeah.
Actually, it's bad enough. Actually, there's four people in a room and they're not quite on the beat. But when one of them is actually in Florida or whatever it was. But I think he loved the idea of it possibly more than the actual, you know, sonic outcome.
Yeah.
But you say you guys are just sending files back and forward and adding
bits. Yeah, that's more or less what we're doing. And both Jeremy, the guitarist, and I, we just, you know, we love writing songs, and the fact that we haven't done that, either of us, for about 20 years, we just suddenly kind of felt a sort of song-shaped hole in our lives, I think, so we thought we should try doing it again.
But you did take this very, very seriously, didn't you? Because I think before you became a novelist, you were looking for a record contract. I mean, with a certain amount of ambition.
With a certain amount of ambition and no sense at all of how to go about it, I think.
How did you go about it?
You know, just the probably the worst possible way of getting 30 or 40 cassettes reproduced and putting them in jiffy bags and sending them to record labels and that kind of thing. So
they would be used as, you know, door.
Yes, exactly.
Exactly. Yeah.
I mean, exactly the same way I got published as a novelist, actually. But I was one of the very few cases, I guess, where I actually got lucky in that case, and
my manuscript
landed on the doorstep of someone who actually read manuscripts that landed on her doorstep. So that was Anna Haycroft, also known as Alice Thomas Ellis, who was the fiction editor of Duckworth at the time.
What an incredible piece of luck! So you did that without an agent.
Yeah, I didn't have an agent or anything like that at the time. So, yeah.
So what happened? She rang you up or she sent you a postcard?
Her husband, Colin Haycroft, who was the publisher at Duckworth, phoned me up 4 months after I'd sent off the manuscript.
So 4 months of absolute silence.
Had you sent off many manuscripts?
Yeah, I sent off to about 15 or 16 people, I think, and, you know, stopped really waiting for the replies because usually you didn't get a reply at all. And then the phone just rang one evening in my bedsit in Coventry, which was where I was living at the time, and it was this very posh voice. I knew it was something special because there was no voice like this in my social circle. He sounded like a retired colonel or something. And he just said, "Hello, it's Colin Haycroft here. Anna loves your book. I think we'll publish it next year. Would that be all right?"
What an absolute! Does that again only happens in movies?
Best phone call ever.
What an incredible story! It's the phone call that should have happened at the end of Sideways, but never does. Yes. The reverse, in fact, happens. Isn't it? How absolutely extraordinary!
Yeah.
And how long did it take between getting that call and seeing your book in W.H. Smith?
I never saw the book in W.H. Smith. But it seemed an age at the time, but actually it was quite quick. Now that I know a bit more about publishing, they did it in about 6 months. But they did it. It was a slim hardback volume, which sold, and I remember this vividly because it's the kind of thing you don't forget. 272 copies. 272 copies. And
you would remember that. It's true.
The rest were pulped, and I signed 20 of them. I remember.
Where did you sign them?
In the Duckworth office, he said, sign these for collectors.
And they will be worth quite a lot of money.
On A Books now, and they go for about £300.
Do they? How fantastic.
Yeah.
Absolutely sensational. What a brilliant story. That's very good. And you also wrote later on some, because I just wondered if you'd had some ambitions to be a rock journalist. I mean, you wrote sleeve notes for Hatfield of the North. And,
I forget.
I think the High Alarmist.
I forget some of this stuff because I did a part of my life. I keep forgetting about is for about a year and a half in the early 90s. I was a music journalist for The Wire.
Oh, well, I didn't know that.
The very esoteric, highbrow.
Still going.
Music magazine. Still going.
Edited by Chris Bonner, sitting on the bus.
I think I had to stop buying it because I just didn't understand what they were writing or what they were writing about in the end. But I covered sort of more mainstream stuff for them. But I did a lot of nice, they gave me a lot of nice gigs. I did a great interview with Steve Reich, interviewed Michael Nyman. Talked to...
It was the headline, Steve Reich in the afternoon. Hilarious. How perfect you finished up on that magazine. The person who at school was listening to Henry Cow.
Yes.
His destiny, if he was going to go anywhere,
was to write for The Wire, yeah.
Yeah.
Tragically, I don't think during my tenure there that members of Henry Cow made any recordings or played many gigs, because I never got the chance to
Who were your big interviews? Who do you remember interviewing?
Steve Reich, Michael Nyman, those were the two ones I mainly remember. A wonderful singer who I still really rate, not many people have heard of her, called Annette Peacock. Do you know Annette Peacock?
I do.
Who made an album in the 70s called I'm the One, which was a big influence on David Bowie, actually. In fact, I think he even covered the track. And that was really nice, spending an afternoon with her. So I did do the music journalist thing. I think I wrote about the Canterbury scene for The Guardian a couple of times as well, I think, that sort of stuff.
As in the kind of the whole, this would be Caravan.
The whole Caravan, Soft Machine. And all Soft Machine sort
Hatfield.
Of thing. Yep.
And Pink Floyd, I suppose, part of that too.
Yeah, very, very tangentially. Is that the word?
Tangentially.
Yes.
Could be. Kevin Ayers, was he mentioned in your piece?
I'm sure he was.
Yeah.
I'm sure he was.
Yeah. What's the fascination with that particular period?
I think there's something about that music which I realise now, in retrospect, you also find in my novels, or I try to put in my novels, which is basically the music is, unlike most progressive music or avant-garde music, it's actually quite accessible and very tuneful, and it has a humorous edge to it, it has a kind of ironic edge to it. But there are kind of quirky, experimental things happening around the edges, and that's kind of what I try to do in my novels, that you know, I want to reach a mainstream audience. I want to invite the reader in. I don't want to make the books difficult or inaccessible. But then once I've got them, then I like to kind of throw the odd curveball, like the fact that the Rotters Club, for instance, which for most of the book is a kind of easy nostalgia trip down the 1970s, ends with a 33-page sentence, which you know, maybe...
James Joyce would have been proud of.
Yeah, and maybe... You know, people wouldn't take that kind of thing on board if they hadn't been kind of let in a bit more gently by all the jokes and that sort of stuff. So I do think there's a kind of crossover between what I'm trying to do in fiction and what a band like Hatfield and the North were trying to do in
music. No, I totally understand that. Yeah. And I think that your use of musical references is just... I think you were one of the first to really do that, actually. It's now become quite a standard procedure, isn't
well,
it? In the same way as movies will soundtrack or they will code a certain year by using a particular track that was a hit that year. It's a kind of shorthand for 1985 or whatever.
Well, The Rotters Club came out in 2001 and High Fidelity is the first, really. That came out in 96 or 97, I think.
Yeah.
So Nick definitely got there before me on that front. But I was certainly probably the first person to use references to Henry Cow as a means of as a means of describing my character's emotional life or lack of it.
Well, members of Henry Cow, we indeed know one, Peter Blakefield. We saw him play the other night.
Yeah, what an extraordinary evening that was.
Absolutely fantastic. Incredible. Describe Blakefield's performance. It was a wonderful show.
Well, it was Peter's birthday. It was Peter Blakefield's 60th birthday party stroke concert. And, you know, at one point up on stage playing his songs, we had Chris Cutler and John Greaves of the Henry Cow rhythm section, and then we had Peter playing guitar and singing. We had Karen Mantler, Carla Bley's daughter, on keyboard.
Superb, yeah.
And we had John Paul Jones just kind of vamping on mandolin. You know, I never thought I would see those five people on stage together. It was just wonderful.
Tremendous.
Yeah.
And really nice to see musicians now sitting down and looking at music stands.
Yes.
Reading, well, not actually charts, but clearly kind of chord patterns.
Yes.
I think the club were actually reading music.
Probably were, yeah. Yeah, now, we've not enough of that.
Yes,
I don't think.
We not enough at all. Now, your event, which we must rigorously plug, because
yes,
on
must.
Friday, October the 7th, I think it is, at King's Place, you are part of a performance called Say Hi to the Rivers and Mountains.
Yes.
Now, tell us about that, because that's with, I think you've worked with Sean O'Hagan before, who was in Micro Disney and I think High Llamas.
Yep.
God, he was on the old whistle test, wasn't he? Micro Disney, I think they were.
Yes. Quite possibly.
Lovely fellow,
quite
isn't he?
Lovely fellow.
Really? Now, what's your association with him? You've done quite a lot of stuff with him.
I have done quite a lot with Sean. This is a weekend long festival called Notes and Letters, which is devoted to collaborations between writers and musicians. We have Will Self giving a lecture on symphonic form and literary form. We have Peter Maxwell Davis, I believe, giving a lecture. And kicking the whole thing off on the Friday evening, Friday, October the 7th, we have the High Llamas in concert with some words by me. And what we're doing is a performance piece that we've written together called Say Hi to the Rivers and the Mountains. Well, what you basically get is an hour-long High Llamas set, which I've chosen and programmed. We have 11 songs performed in sequence. Some of them songs, some of them instrumentals. And in and around this, I've written what I would suppose you call a play. It's certainly a dialogue for three actors. All the dialogue is synced to the music, so the actors have to kind of speak in time to what the musicians are playing and listen to the musicians. It is.
I smell rehearsals.
It's quite rehearsal intensive. It's quite rehearsal intensive. We have Henry Goodman playing the lead part in the play, and I hope he knows what he's let himself in for, because it is quite unlike what actors have to find themselves doing most of the time. But we've done it. We've performed it four or five times before, and it is a unique entertainment, I think. I think of it as 2 hours entertainment, because you get an hour-long play by me and an hour-long set by the High Llamas. They just happen to be performed simultaneously.
Fantastic. Did you do this at Latitude once? Or
we did it
at Latitude
2 years ago.
2 years ago, that's right.
Yep. Yeah. Which was great fun, actually.
It was
such a good festival. And it's the perfect venue for this kind of thing, because you get such an interesting audience at Latitude. Any author will tell you, if you do a reading or a literary event at Latitude, it's just great, because
fantastically
open-minded. Yeah. 400 or 500 people all in a tent, and you know, it's really so much more fun than doing, you know, a bog standard literary festival.
So I can almost say an evangelist for this kind of thing, and there isn't much of it. This kind of these combinations of words and music. It's very unusual. Why do you feel so strongly that you'd like to get involved with this?
I think it goes back again to my weird personal obsessions in the 1970s, which in those days, among other things, were with film music. Cast your mind back to the 1970s. I'm a Billy Wilder obsessive, and I've started to want to possess all his films. Of course, no videotapes yet, so I record them off the television onto audio cassettes. And then I lie awake in bed at night.
So you've got a terrible version of Some Like It Hot or something on a...
It's a very good version, because it's done on a line. It's done with a cable. I'm not holding a mic in front of the TV.
Yeah.
So I have a perfect kind of audio recording of it. So what I'm listening to entirely and focusing on is the way that the voices interweave with and intermingle with the soundtrack music. So I become very interested in what certain kinds of music, certain chords even do, when you put them behind certain bits of dialogue and this sort of thing.
How fascinating.
And I think
they weren't synced, were they? Billy Wilder uses atmosphere music, doesn't he?
Actually, there
are songs.
Sometimes if you listen closely to how it's used in Some Like It Hot, for instance, there is almost a kind of dialogue going on between the soundtrack music and the actual dialogue, I think.
How extraordinary. You must have listened to that many times. You clearly did.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, the way that sometimes different characters' themes recur in kind of ironic forms on the soundtrack, and depending on who is speaking at that time, it makes a when you listen to it closely, undistracted by the images, it makes a vast difference to how you hear the dialogue.
That's fascinating, and also it is a kind of dare one say, a kind of subconscious engineering, isn't it? You're not aware
absolutely.
Of it. You know, see, I'm not aware.
Yeah.
I will go back to that film, which I absolutely adore, and watch that again with that in mind.
When you do become aware of it, I'm a bit too self-conscious about it now, and actually when I when I listen to the way music is used in the cinema these days, first of all, 90% of it is terrible music, and I don't like it on that level. But also, it's begun to seem quite strange, actually. This strange convention that we all accept, that we're kind of watching a movie and people are in a room talking to each other, and suddenly, you know, there's an orchestra playing, and we kind of accept that because we're conditioned to. But when you become aware of it, it's kind of weird, and it can...
Yes, since you put it like that, it's ludicrous.
It is ludicrous. What,
exactly.
And it actually becomes very distracting, which is why I kind of liked the idea that in the collaboration with Sean and the High Llamas, we would actually write something where the relationship between words and music was specific and was there from the beginning. Because what I think doesn't work so well is to take a pre-existing text and to slap a piece of music on it, which some kind of manufacturers of audiobooks and Kindle apps and so on are doing at the moment. I don't know if you've heard about this, but they've started taking kind of Sherlock Holmes stories, and when it gets creepy and atmospheric, they've started... In comes the orchestra.
It's exactly what we're talking about. Yes. Exactly what you don't want.
And I don't think you really want that when you're reading it. And if the writer had never imagined that to start with, then it's kind of doing a kind of violence to the text.
I object to that kind of thing very strongly on principle.
Yeah.
I think I'm just too old to have someone try and order my thoughts and my reactions.
Exactly. But you accept it in the cinema. Yeah.
Well, you don't necessarily accept it, do you?
No.
It's thrust upon you.
It is thrust upon you.
But there was a vogue not long ago for trying to do this stuff without any music at all. It's kind of this
what,
kind
the dogma
of brave, yeah, this brave kind of new convention where we've got to treat our audience as being grown up enough to be able to sort this stuff out for themselves.
Or if you see Louis Buñuel's later films, which are fantastic, he was of course completely deaf by this point, so he never bothered to put any music on his,
great excuse.
His final films, because
I can't hear it. Why should anybody else? Very good. Well, look, Jonathan, that's fantastic. This show, let's plug this again, and we will plug this vigorously on the website too.
Yeah.
On Friday, October the 7th, at King's Place, which I can't remember where King's Place is now, actually. I've
just
been
down
there
the road from here.
It's near here,
just back near the Guardian station.
It's near the Guardian building. Of course it is. Yep. Absolutely. And that's you and various others and Sean O'Hagan. And and we must play. Sorry, I completely forgot to play. We must play the peer group. Now, just briefly, you sent me an email yesterday saying that you were responsible, I think, for the music on tracks 1 and tracks 4. Track 1, I think, is called Life is the Kingdom. Would that be
Is
right?
It the Kingdom, it's called.
Is It the Kingdom, sorry. And the other one's called, I think, Travel's Cup and Lip.
Yep.
Now, you can introduce. The easiest way you will introduce those. I listened to them this morning. There is, I have to say, an almost loungish jazz feel to them.
Mm.
Which I was interested by. Was that the group? That's what you sounded like at college.
We haven't talked about my love of lounge music. Which is something completely
different. We're about to hear what is. I mean, I heard that and immediately thought, please, somebody send 2 mackerel pâtés and a Caesar salad to table 27. But it was quite lounge. Now, tell me about your interest in that.
Which track are we going
to? Well, you choose the track. Like? It's up to you. You can trade 1 or 3 or 4 because you're the composers of both.
Yeah.
Which would you like to introduce?
Well, let's hear the first track, which is called Is It the Kingdom? I think has a slightly early Steely Dan feel to it, actually. I think it's quite piano-heavy. And I think that's the kind of feel we're going for on this. But maybe you didn't pick that up at all.
No, I think I did. Steely Dan had a tremendously lounge thing, but only more later on, I think.
Yeah.
If you stuck with them, as I did, up until their the reunion record. And also Donald Fagen's sensational solo albums, Nightfly. These are great records.
Yeah, yep.
But I think we're going to do a proper Radio 2 thing here, Fraser. We're going to thank Jonathan Cove very much for being on this podcast. And thank everyone for listening. Replug the date on October the 7th. And we're going to leave you now, listeners, with the peer group and a little bit of... which track was it again?
It's called Is It the Kingdom? It's a song our drummer, Ralph, has written, inspired by the death of his father. And his thoughts, his rather elegiac thoughts, I think, about the kind of country that he thought he was building in the kind of post-war consensus years and what that turned into post-1979.
And you're not the singer, you're the keyboard player on this.
I am the keyboard
player. So what's the lineup? There's the singer, the drummer?
Piano, guitar, drums, bass and vocals. Yeah.
Listeners, we give you the peer group.
Slip away now into the old woodland. Slip away now into the dark who is gonna walk beside you and who will take your hand? I can see that this is England, but is it the kingdom? Is it the kingdom? I can see that this is England, but is it the kingdom? Is it the kingdom? What is underfoot? What is underhand? Whose silky footstep treads down the downtrodden? Is what we're doing what should be done? Is what we're doing what should be done? England, but is it the kingdom? Is it the kingdom? I can see that this is England, but is it the kingdom? Is it the kingdom? Slip away now. Should I ask? Slip away now. Who should I ask to walk beside you? Walk beside you. And who will take your hand?
If you've been affected by any of the issues in this podcast, go to wordmagazine.co.uk or apply at your newsagent every month.